radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand out at the Fire Department Instructors Conference in Indianapolis. Our rundown for this month, going to talk just briefly about a couple of recent accidents, some issues going on with some departments getting feedback over their performance or lack thereof of their 2007 EPA engines with some regeneration issues. And then we'll be spending the rest of the program today, Brother Mike and Tom, talking about some of the new products and introduction of some components that we've seen so far here out at the FDIC. So, Michael, start out here. Some of the recent accidents here we had in Baltimore within the last week or so, had another apparatus-on-apparatus accident there. Want to fill us in on that one?
Yeah, Tom, it is true. Again, at an intersection, two engine companies responding ran into each other. The good news is that nobody was seriously hurt, although there was some extensive apparatus damage. It didn't look to me like anything would be totaled, but certainly damage that would go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars to get both rigs back up. And this just goes added on to the high number of accidents, apparatus on apparatus, that we talked about in the past on the show. I think that is 9 or 10 now that we have in the last couple of years of fire apparatus running into fire apparatus. And it's been well documented on this program as to the reason for that, and a majority of the time it's just apparatus trying to race each other and beat each other in, as was the case in a number of those crashes. An update in Houston on that crash, it was determined that the apparatus operator there was not going to be charged. That came out just a short time ago. To get you up to date on that.
Mike, there was also just recently a NIOSH just released their investigation report on the tragic accident up in Boston with Ladder Company 26 that resulted in the fatal injury to Lieutenant Kelly. Want to fill us in on that. As I understand it, there were some key factors that were brought out in that report that think really reinforce some of the things that we've been speaking about over the years. But fill us in on what NIOSH had to say about the Boston accident.
Yeah, Brother Tom, it was a very damning report as it relates to that accident. Certainly, the cause of the accident, the major cause, was the brake failure of the apparatus, and the fact that there were actually brake components. The brakes were redone, and components that were should not have been on the rig were put on the rig. Different brake chambers. I believe it should have had 36s, and it had 30s, or vice versa. And that certainly contributed to the accident. One of the things that we had said for some time is the weight issue. We keep talking about weight on this program, and the fact that the vehicle was probably overweight, although that wasn't necessarily documented in the report. Obviously, poor maintenance. And that is just not necessarily a Boston Fire Department problem. But as we go across the country, it's really a stark contrast. Generally, fleets are either well taken care of or they're generally not taken care of very well. At all. And in this case, there were tremendous problems with maintenance and the fleet and taking care of the fleet. Inadequate training. The apparatus operator actually testified as part of his deposition that he had never been trained in the use of air brakes at all. And that is just absolutely unforgivable that you would drive such a big truck that stops with air brakes and not having any training on that system at all. And again, I think that is a symptom of a much greater problem, and a much, again, not only a Boston Fire Department problem, but a problem throughout the country. We quite frankly don't know enough about what we're doing. As I go around the country and train operators, something as simple as asking the question, does your truck have anti-lock brakes or not? And we are getting into a period of time where many of the fleets out there are what I call mixed fleets, where some of the trucks are older that are not equipped with anti-lock brakes, and then some of the trucks are equipped with anti-lock brakes. And of course, if you get into an emergent situation where you would have to stop the truck, two totally different ways to stop the truck. With an anti-lock brake truck, obviously you would put your foot direct pressure on the pedal and keep it there until you come to a stop. And unlike a car, many of the trucks that we tested doing this, you don't get the foot massage. So if you're waiting for that, that's not going to happen. The only indication that the system is working is at startup you should get an amber light on the dash or a yellow light that says ABS. If you don't have an ABS-equipped truck, why then you are going to do what we call threshold braking, where you're going to hold the pedal down until you feel the wheels are going to lock up, and then you are allegedly going to let go of the pedal and get the wheels free spinning and then get back down on the brakes again. And basically, that methodology is just trying to mimic what anti-lock brakes do automatically. You're trying to do manually. So we just simply don't know enough about what we're trying to do. And inadequate training in a case of the Boston accident was highlighted as another major factor. And then finally, again, well documented on this program, the failure to wear seatbelts. We're just not doing as well as we could or should with seatbelt compliance. Went to a roundtable discussion here at the Fire Department Instructors Conference, and there was it was asked by the panel from the audience, and there had to be a good 800 people in the audience, how many had mandatory seatbelt policies, and everybody raised their hand, and then we talk about compliance and enforcement, and not everybody was raising their hands as it relates to that.
Well, you know, Mike, the other thing that I thought was interesting in the NIOSH report is they cited in the state of Massachusetts, apparently in, I don't know whether it's in the vehicle and traffic law or in what segment of the motor vehicle law it exists, but it specifically exempts emergency vehicles or people operating on or about emergency vehicles from wearing their seatbelts. And to go along with the seatbelt comment, the NIOSH report indicated in the state of Massachusetts should probably rethink that and mandate the use of seatbelts in fire apparatus. But as Mike just alluded to, it's one thing to have a rule and a regulation. It's another whole thing to have an enforcement for that and to be able to back the policy up with some type of reasonable disciplinary measures when the regulation is not followed. So.
Yeah, well, that's not the only state either. In the state of New York, the policy is the same. Many states grant exemptions for farm tractors and police cars and ambulances and fire apparatus as it relates to a seatbelt usage. One of the states that does not, that I know for sure, is the state of California, where you are mandated to wear a seatbelt in a fire truck.
Interesting. Well, moving on, within the course of the last couple of weeks on several of the different fire service websites, there's been a posting put up by Chief Thomas Wood. Chief Wood is a very well-known and respected chief of the Boca Raton, Florida Fire Department. It's someone that Mike and I were put onto and had personal conversation with the chief some time ago. The chief was lamenting some of the current issues that he's experiencing with his medic unit and one of his fire trucks that he has in his fleet that is equipped with the now reasonably well-known 2007 EPA engines that require a diesel particulate filter. They have in Boca Raton, and I'm sure this has been the case in other departments, but possibly not as well either publicized or circulated. But in Chief Wood's case, he has five medic units that are built on Freightliner chassis with Mercedes engines, specifically in his case. And he also has a Sutphen Tower that has a Caterpillar engine, and all of Six of those vehicles were equipped with 2007 EPA engines with diesel particulate filters, and they've experienced, after talking to the chief, it seemed like an unusually high number of incidents and things that we were told early on prior to these engines hitting the marketplace, from both the engine folks and chassis people, the different component vendors, that these types of things couldn't and shouldn't happen. But in Boca Raton, and again, well, I'm sure that there's other communities out there that possibly have experienced this, and Chief Wood wanted to get the word out that he was somewhat concerned and wanted to know in our phone conversation why the fire service had not been exempted from these EPA regulations. Military got an exemption, and unfortunately, the fire service we reviewed as a low-use agency with respect to the number of apparatus and engines that we have out there as compared to Class 6, 7, and 8 commercial trucks that are running up and down the highway all the time that have many more engine miles and hours. And the thought was that if we weren't going to, you know, have other specific exemptions for folks other than the military, that the fire service really wouldn't qualify. And those of you that maybe have not seen Chief Wood's testimony, it's be worthwhile to go up and go check that out. The chief made a parallel to the U.S. Army or somebody in the military operating a tank, being involved in a battle, and having the tank engine go into regeneration, and for the commander of the field forces fighting the war to ask for a temporary timeout while the tank engine regenerated so they could then go back and engage. And the chief made a very compelling argument that there was a pretty strong parallel between the use of the military and the use of how we use our apparatus and ambulances, medic units, whatever, in very critical, time-constrained conditions where if something happens that wasn't supposed to happen, there's a pretty good chance it's going to happen while we're trying to do something on our watch. And we'll keep the our listeners advised further as we get other feedback about departments that are experiencing an unknown number of regeneration issues where they've had some issues of trying to get their rigs back up on the street. So now we're going to move into some of the new products that we have, Mike and I have seen in the last day or so out here at the Fire Department Instructors Conference. As most listeners know, this is one of the kickoff larger conferences of the year, and the one that for the at least probably going back the last 4 to 5 years has now become almost the unspoken tradition that if apparatus builder or any one of the component folks that supply products, goods, and services that we use in the fire service, they tend to use this show as the platform or the introduction, very similar to what the what happens with the auto shows that go around the country through the course of the year. And at the Detroit Auto Show, that's the premier introduction for the year that people have used the FDIC as their launch for their new products. So with that, we're going to go down a list of some of the things, not in any particular order, but things that Brother Mike and I have seen as we've wandered around the convention center and the Lucas Oil Stadium. The one thing, Mike, that struck me was a lot of buzz about green technology with the environment being what it is, with the price of oil now once again on the rise. I know for a number of years I've always thought it was with the somewhat cynical view that the gasoline would always be reasonably priced, whatever your definition of reasonable was, during the winter months. And then magically, as you approach the month of May and the Memorial Day, gasoline price just spiked right up. Where I live in Western New York, they claim we have high gas prices because we're at the end of the pipeline. Well, I've been looking for the pipeline, and I haven't found the end yet. I just frankly think we get screwed. You know, I was down in Virginia a couple weeks ago and bought gas for $2.61 a gallon. I come home in Western New York, the great Empire State, and it's $2.99. Now, I realize some of that is taxes, but after a while, it's my backyard looks like something like some animals have attacked it. I'm digging and I'm looking for that end of the pipeline. But at any rate, Green Products have Green Technology has now been introduced into the our apparatus, and one of the apparatus builders, HME Aarons Fox, had built a demonstrator unit that was CNG powered. It happened to be a pumper that was on their HME's SFO, which is their short wheelbase chassis, and it was powered by a Cummins Westport CNG engine. And lest our listeners think that they know that meant that you were running around with something of small horsepower, that the unit was rated at 320 horsepower and had 1,000 foot-pounds of torque. So while in some communities, this, I know it's reasonably common around in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area, that they'll see CNG-powered buses and metro transport vehicles, also pretty common in other parts of the country as well, that we now have a CNG fire apparatus that's been introduced to the marketplace, and we'll see how that kind of plays out. Taking that maybe in a little bit different direction, Rosenbauer introduced, and they had two vehicles in their display area that had Green Star idle reduction technology, as they called it. And the concept here is that where we use the apparatus and whatever rated, be it a medium block or a big block diesel engine to get us from the station to the scene of the incident, it's pretty typical then that the apparatus spends a great deal of its time idling. In talking to some of the fire pump people, where there's a move afoot to downsize the physical amount of space that it takes on an engine for the traditional fire pump and the plumbing and everything that we do there. In one of the conversations that Mike and I had, that particular manufacturer stated that through some research that they did, and we don't know how wide this was, but they had determined that pumpers spend less than 6% of their time actually engaged in the pump gear and actively involved with pumping a line and pressurizing the water, no matter what the incident was. So if you look at our total number of runs that you use and the number of times that you actually use the large-sized horsepower engine to power the fire pump, without a doubt, it's a very, very low percentage. So the approach that Rosenbauer has taken is to use an auxiliary power unit that once the vehicle arrives on scene, and assuming again that the pump is not engaged, that the auxiliary power unit will take over powering the auxiliary appliances on the apparatus. So for example, you have an LED lighting package. The auxiliary power unit then will supply 12 volt power to the emergency warning lights, to your heater and air conditioner, other components that would normally be supplied with chassis power, and could also provide a minimum of 8 kW of 120 volt power to support operations for if you had a cable reel off or you had scene lighting with fixed and telescopic lighting around the vehicle. So basically you're taking the power plant, the diesel engine, out of the equation and using the auxiliary power unit to be able to power some of the support things that we do on the fire ground. And some of the advantages by doing this, you're going to use only a quarter of the fuel that you normally would. Now, maybe years ago we would think, Mike, hey, fuel costs, no big deal. I mean, we just mentioned about fuel prices, diesel fuel, unless at least where we live out in the East, diesel fuel is always more expensive than any one of the other grades of gasoline. So if you have a large fleet of apparatus and you were used to using at having the engine sit there and the engine idle for a 60-minute period, where it typically might use 3.5 gallons of fuel, you're now going to take that and you're going to use only 25% of that. So there's a cost savings there. Secondarily, we're lowering the emissions because the engine is not sitting there and idling, and we're not pumping that stuff out into the atmosphere. With that, because we're using the engine less and we're not recording all those engine hours, we're going to extend the service intervals that we'd have
for regeneration,
as well as for normal, just whatever your PM cycles are, there's going to be some savings there. So Rosenbauer had kind of a unique approach. And I have to say, not being real familiar with the technology until Mike and I had some conversations with the people there, it seems to me like that's a pretty practical approach to looking at some of the issues that we're facing in the fire service. They had two units that had the Green Star idle reduction technology on display, one that was a demonstrator unit on a custom chassis with a 1,500-gallon pump and a 750-gallon water tank. And if you were to walk around the unit, other than the fact that for display purposes, they had it set up with little green LED lights that were kind of like a tip-off that there was something different on the vehicle, you would have walked around it and not thought twice about the fact as to what kind of unit it was. And they also had a unit on display for the Tempe, Arizona Fire Department for engine 271, which is their downtown engine that runs out of their main station. That was built on a Spartan Furion chassis with their rear mount pump, and while it was a slightly smaller chassis, it still had the Green Star technology. And from what I could recall, having been a number of years ago in Tempe, in terms of the configuration of the vehicle, it pretty much mimicked what Tempe standard rear mount engine companies look like, with their pump panels and their arrangement of attack lines and so forth. So it was kind of interesting, and certainly a little bit of maybe not necessarily what Mike and I were expecting. Now, Mike, coming into the Lucas Oil Stadium, you just see all these aerials up in the air and everything. What was your first impression as to what you thought we're going to see before we took off, on our little mission?
Well, Tom, certainly it I didn't think it revolved around a green technology, so that was certainly a breath of fresh air. I think one of the things that occurred that we had prognosticated was that there wasn't nearly the new product level of new products that we had seen in past years, and we had said last year on this show that there probably wasn't going to be a lot of that due to the fact of manufacturers taking research and development money and having to adequately place 2010 engines, EPA-compliant engines, in the apparatus with the new redesign that they would have to do to accommodate those engines. And so I think that played out to be true. But the green technology certainly was a breath of fresh air. On the Rosenbauer rigs, the way they were set up, the way it was explained to us is that some of that was actually taken from the over-the-road trucking industry. You see those big tractor trailers that are alongside the road at night or in truck stops where those folks are sleeping. Again, fuel is everything to those folks. To save a gallon or two of fuel over the course of a trip is a big deal every hour or every couple hours. And so part of the technology used in the fire engine was actually taken from that industry as far as it relates to shutting the engine down and using the generator instead. And what was interesting, we had asked a question, I believe Tom did, about what happens to the battery, and there's sensors where if the battery gets below a certain level, it will actually kick the diesel engine back on automatically to build up the power in the battery, and then it goes back over to a generator. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's correct, Mike. I mean, there were some pretty nice arrangement of, I'd say, built-in faults that if certain conditions arose that, and left, say, maybe momentarily unattended, that the vehicle wouldn't go into a brownout condition and to a point where it wouldn't be operable. So be interesting to see how that is two things, how it is either accepted by the fire service, which looks initially to Mike and I that some pretty nice thought put into it, and then additionally, you know, Rosenbauer is the first out of the gate with this. So let's see who the next fast follower is and to go pick up on that. Mike alluded to the fact that there really wasn't any big unveilings. It was more just, to me, tweaks on different components, but there was one large unveiling that occurred at the Pierce Oshkosh booth, where they did unveil the new look of the Oshkosh Striker, which is the unit they had was a 6x6 ARF unit that had a very dramatic, very different look from what the previous Striker looked like, or other typical U.S. built ARF units, a very aerodynamic, I'm not really sure, I'll call it a fiberglass skin. I'm not really sure whether the skin was fiberglass. It certainly had that appearance, but a very, very aerodynamic look with a swooping windshield. And it does have a new type of pulse delivery technology for the application of the dry chemical powder that the unit carries. So it was that was something. And obviously, there's not too many shows that you go to where there's an ARF unit on display. So that was getting a lot of attention. There was also something that, as we were walking around and with my faithful partner in hand, I turned around and looked, and it's like losing your son at the carnival. We momentarily lost Brother Mike, and when he went to stop and to look at a new platform that Pierce had. So, Mike, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, Tom, it's a aluminum ladder platform. It's a complete redesign of that unit. Some of the salient new features on that unit, it has a waterway that is affixed to the top left as you're in the basket looking back towards the chassis, waterway up to the top left of the ladder. That was designed in a manner to keep the apparatus under 12 feet so that it could fit in an old Northeast firehouse that has a 12-foot door opening from a marketing standpoint. The basket, unlike the previous Pierce dumpster baskets, the basket on this unit was completely redesigned. It has a really new, sleek look. That has much more usability than the previous design of the Pierce basket. It has a three-section like most rear mounts, but what was interesting about the piece is that the Pierce was able to get it so that the basket could go to a negative angle at 270 degrees around the back end of the apparatus. They can get to, I believe, a negative 6 or 8 degrees. It was a sharp-looking unit. What did you see when you came to pick me up?
Yeah, well, after momentarily losing Mike, because I had a particular interest in military apparatus, Pierce also had on display a Velocity chassis, non-walk-in rescue, one of several units that they're being delivered to the U.S. Navy. That unit, again, it was a combination of a rescue and a command unit. Had a 22-foot aluminum body, had a Lima 40 kW direct drive generator, which was supplying 120 volt power for the light tower and the other appliances, as well as a 14 CFM breathing air onboard breathing air compressor that supplied a 4-bottle 6,000 psi cascade system. And was a 3-door cab that had an L-shaped desk and a resource area inside the cab, and that was kind of interesting. One of the other wandered over to KME, and they have introduced a new Predator chassis, which was designed to accept any of the 2010 EPA compliant engines. And what was interesting there is, while KME over the period of years has always made like ongoing upgrades and improvements to their cab and their chassis product line, this is pretty much is an all new cab. Is that the cab is now 100 inches wide, outside skin to outside skin. And they actually had two of those on display, one that was built up as a pumper that had an international, the Max Force 13 engine, which is rated at 475 horsepower, and they also had a rear mount Quint with the new design Predator cab, and that had the Cummins ISX 15 model engine, which is 600 horsepower. So some of the things in looking at the cab, in addition to the wider cab, is also has a wider door openings, particularly at the crew cab area. The way the door, the width of the door, and how it opens with respect to, you know, coming 90 degrees to the side, with a much wider cab step area. And while that was visually apparent, it became very apparent when you went to get in, and more importantly, get out of the cab, that you notice in some of these cabs now, where because size is becoming an issue in terms of overall length, that they've compacted and narrowed the step areas, which doesn't normally seem like a big deal when you're going in the cab, but trying to step out of the cab while maintaining 3 points of contact sometimes can be challenging. So folks at the cab engineers at KME did a very nice job by designing that. And one of the other crazy things that Mike and I do when you see us at these shows, we'll get in and out of the driver's seat and the officer's seat, and then we'll go switch around. I was noted that the cab had a brand new wraparound dash design, which was quite nice, and sitting in the officer's seat, while I'm not particularly tall at 5'10", in a lot of cabs anymore, but in the officer seat area, it's one of the most common complaints, particularly if guys are running out on an EMS call or something that's a non-fire call, where they don't have the bunker pants on, that there's not a lot of leg room up in front. And it was one of the things I noted in the new Predator cab, that there was a fair amount of leg room the way they had designed that over in the officer's area. And once again, they had a new platform design that they're going to use for their mid-mounts and rear mounts. And Mike, just before the break, why don't you fill us in on that? That once again had the opportunities to converse with a couple of the engineers that worked on that project. And Mike, what'd you learn?
Yeah, again, Tom, they did a real nice job. But before we go into that, just a quick comment on the Predator cab. The vision, when I sat in the driver's seat of that, was just really impressive. The amount that you could see. We went to some other products during the show, and the field of vision to drive and be safe in the vehicle and to see the mirrors and use the mirrors was limited at best. And this really gave that new cab. I was really impressed with that cab. They did an excellent job integrating the 2010 engine, and just the room and the field of vision. Kudos to the engineers at KME. They did a great job. As to the new platform, they have a hands-free door latch. You just bang the thing from the outside, and you can get in. That was a pretty interesting and pretty neat. And they had photo illumination floor and rung covers. And what they did is they took a laser and they cut the same thing that the new material that you would see on rungs of a ladder that's luminescent, and they actually put it on the floor of the basket inside and outside, and I tried to slip on it, and it was just like sandpaper. I mean, you couldn't slip off this thing if you tried. And with the illuminescence in it, you are going to be able to see it coming from a mile away. So that was a pretty good addition to that unit. And also what they did is they used to have an edge going around the whole basket that was about 8 inches on the side, and then a place where you could walk in and out from each side. And they ran the basket all the way out to the end on each end of the basket from side to side, and eliminated that and got more room in the basket so that 3 bunkered up firefighters could fit comfortably in the basket, but still retain the scrub area and the usability and that angle of approach that we talk about to try and rescue people. So, again, great job on the redesign of that new platform for the KME folks.
And we'll, this is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We'll be back, the Apparatus Architects, after a quick break.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, and we're going to get right back into review of some of the units on display. And one of the new, I think that was came across as almost like a concept vehicle, but an awful lot of thought put into it, was Crimson Fire Apparatus has a new new offering called the Transformer. And the unit on display was built on a Spartan MetroStar chassis, short wheelbase, 178 inches, overall length of 31 feet. And I guess we got a premise that last article Mike and I wrote for the Apparatus Architect, we entitled it, and it was somewhat of a tongue-in-cheek commentary, was the return of the mini pumper. And our thought was it wasn't that people are going back to buying a Ford F-550 and putting a PTO pump and 300 gallons of water, throwing two guys on it and rocking out the door. The concept was that people have now begun to recognize that we can build fire trucks that can be 36, 37, 38 feet. We can make them whatever length we want, as big as they fit in the firehouse. But in a lot of cases, the maneuverability is not there. They don't get around in the community all that well. And after you buy one of these battleships, you then might find out that it was just too big. So our thought was we were going to do an article on units that were shorter, smaller, as maneuverable, and but still maintain all the capabilities of a typical standard Class A pumper, however that definition fits in your particular community. Well, the folks from Crimson, because there's a lot of folks now doing rescue pumpers or rescue engines, they took this concept a step further, and Jim Somme, the chief operating officer of Crimson, took Mike and I around the vehicle to explain to us some of the thoughts and the designs of how this unit evolved. So the unit's short. It's powered by a 425 horsepower Cummins ISL engine with a 3000 series EBS transmission. You can put this on a mates up with a big block chassis if you want, but it has a PTO driven Darley pump rated at 1250 GPM, and it's underneath the vehicle, right, and just ahead of the rear axle, but is designed in such a way with the manifolding and everything, in a couple hours you can drop the whole pump out. So it doesn't have a standard pump house or pump box, right? If the doors are rolled down on this unit, other than the fact that it had a couple of cross lays ahead of the body, you would probably initially think the thing was just a non-walk-in rescue truck until you walked around the back and saw the hose load. But it has side mount controls that are operated hydraulically with crank handles, which was a design that Crimson came up with. It has, as we mentioned, low mount cross lays, intakes and discharges on each side of the vehicle ahead of the rear axle. So a very, very unique unit, I think, that's going to have a lot of possibilities. It also had, on the right side of the unit, rather than losing compartment space to having ladders that slide into the body, understanding that if you do that, you're losing either tank capacity or body storage capacity. It had a hydraulic ladder rack, but was integrated into the side of the body with side panels that, again, it looked like you would have upper type locker or coffin compartments, but a very, very uniquely designed unit, and was something that really caught Mike's and my attention over a unit that I think has got an awful lot of potential. If you look at what Pierce did a number of years ago with their Puck design by removing the pump from the traditional place that it is located on the vehicle and driving it in a different fashion and having intakes and discharges in a somewhat non-standard location. And some people looked back at that and skeptics and said, I don't really think that's going to take off. I think Pierce put something out a couple of weeks ago that they had already built and delivered their 300 Puck style units of all different types of configurations. So if you want to roll back for the listeners that have been around in the fire service for a while, when rear mount pumps started to be seen in the mid-'80s and late-'80s and then really took off in the early 1990s. A lot of people said, oh, that, you know, that concept is, you know, that'll die. You know, that won't be around. Well, if you look at rear mount pumps are here, they're certainly not in the majority, but they're here to stay. And I think taking the fire pump and downsizing the physical size of that, Pat had a discussion, Mike and I, the other day with an apparatus officer, and we're commenting on, you know, people buying 2,000 GPM or 2,250 GPM pumps and having them as standard for everything in the fleet, and what percentage of times, based on what we had talked about earlier in the program, the number of times that a fire pump is even engaged, much less, you know, it's a one-line or two-line fire. It's great to have all that firepower when you need it, but that certainly comes at an expense. So, you know, is a 1250 GPM pump adequate for your community? That's a question that you folks need to answer. But in a lot of cases, you look at if traditionally, you know, we have incrementally started with smaller horsepower engines and 500-gallon or even smaller water tanks than that, with back in the day when Mike and I joined the fire service, a 1,000 GPM pump was looked at as being a big capacity pump. Then came along 1250 and 1500s, and now, you know, it with a typical midship pump and still having, you know, traditional intake and discharge manifolds, you can get them to 2250, and then you see industrial rigs that can go up to 4,000 GPM. You have to look at, you know, how much firepower and how much horsepower do you need to be able to motivate that down the road.
You know what's funny, Brother Tom? That 750 pumper that I first rode out on with a 300-gallon booster tank, it put fires out.
Well, exactly, you know, and that's why today, I mean, if somebody said you had if you had purchased a Class A pump and put a 1,000 GPM pump on it, rated pump, people would look at you like, I guess you must have been poor, you ran out of money. You know, there was some conversation of people talking about putting 1,250 GPM pumps in what years ago would have been referred to as a mini pumper chassis. So I think we've gotten too overwhelmed with the physical size of all of this equipment, and whether it's going to be a recognition of let's looking at the service that we deliver, let's look at the number of times that we use this. I mean, are you still going to need large caliber streams for defensive operations? Absolutely. All right. Although, you know, we didn't get a chance to go talk to too many of those people, but there are several units on display here that have ultra high pressure water fog systems on them. So you look at it, for those of us that have been around for quite a while, we're now almost coming back around full circle to say, let's look at some of the old tactics and strategies and things that Lloyd Lehman laid out, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, of saying that, you know, we're going to go back to high pressure fog streams, which are, you know, streams greater typically than 500 PSI, but very low GPM water delivery capability. So you look at this, there's just about, you know, no matter which thread or how you want to believe you want to set up your firefighting tactics and operations, there's somebody providing the products and the hardware out there to allow you to do that.
One of the things that I don't think our listeners consider either when they're buying these big pumps is it's just not that simple. A bigger pump adds more weight. You may end up having to change out the axles, which costs more money. You may end up having to have a bigger horsepower engine, which means more room, which means a different kind of chassis or cab, which means more expense and more fuel consumption. So, like we've said before on this program, it's not just one component, but one component that acts and interacts with all the other components that it's not just as simple as buying a bigger pump and paying a cost for that, but the overall cost of the unit escalates dramatically because of all the other components that are affected by having a big pump. And one of the things that drive Brother Tom and I absolutely nuts is when we go out and do fire protection studies and we see engine company apparatus that are set up with pre-connected lines or other lines and devices that can only deliver 25% of the pump's rated pump capacity. That's one of your favorites, right, Brother Tom?
Yeah, and it boils down to what's the mission of the vehicle going to be? That's the first question you want to throw out there and get that issue on the table, get it hammered out and addressed, and that will help you get you down the appropriate alley, you know, once you hit the toll barrier and you know what lane you want to go into. Having said that, one of the other things that that struck Mike and I in walking around were the number of aerial devices set up to operate as quints. Kind of goes along with what's happening with pumpers now. We don't have single function apparatus, but different mechanisms that the manufacturers have come up with to make it easier to load the hose on a rear mount aerial device. Almost gone are the days where you have the hose bed ahead of the turntable and you're shooting it out underneath the turntable and having to raise the aerial to pack the hose, although that certainly is an option. Crimson has a device called the HydroLoad that it has the capability of carrying up to 1,000 feet of 5-inch hose. Device actually swings off the side of the vehicle and lowers it to within 20 inches of the ground, and it's about 35 inches away from the body and allows you to rack the supply line while you're standing on the ground. And while the device might seem like, wow, that's going to add some expense and here's some other things there, to me, it's much safer to be standing on the ground than it is to be climbing up somewhere. And that is one of the things that had really struck Mike and I in walking around. We saw, I don't know how many rigs, on the right front corner of the body. We're talking the officer side on a pumper or a quint to see. We saw three was very common. We even saw a couple of units that had four NFPA-approved folding steps up the right front corner of the body with the light, with somewhere along the line a handrail, so everything was 1901 compliant. And you'd look at the vehicle and the design of it and say, when you get to that top step, where are you going, or why would you even want to walk up the vehicle there?
Absolutely.
Again, so if you can be doing stuff on the ground, whether it's loading hose, getting the tools and equipment that you need most frequently, racking supply line, which obviously is a little tough to do on a pumper, all right, without being on the ground, but pulling attack lines, you want to try to eliminate stepping and having access to getting to higher places wherever possible. And again, no disrespect to the people that make folding steps, but if there's one item that I'd like to eliminate in a fire service, it's a folding step. If you got to get up the apparatus, you climb up the back and you go up a fixed step, you go up a little access ladder, you go up something that's got some degree of safety rather than stepping on something, you know, and having to ascend three or four of those in a straight line and then do, I guess, a half gainer into the top of the hose bed. At any rate, Rosenbauer has a product called the Easy Load that has a 1,500-pound capacity and that moves away from the body with a series of hydraulic arms and allows you, once again, to rack the supply line on an aerial device without having to climb up or having to try to fish hose through a chute through, you know, underneath the turntable and things like that. So you can see that the manufacturers overall here at this particular show, while take the Oshkosh redesigned Striker and the Crimson Transformer, a lot of the other things that we have seen to date, and not see that there could have been something that, you know, squirreled away that we just haven't come, Mike and I haven't come across yet. Most of a lot of these products were just improvements and variations on a theme, in a lot of cases either to make it safer, a little bit easier to maintain in some cases, particularly go back to some of the cab redesigns for fluid access points and things like that. And it's minor tweaks, but things that are really important if they can improve the safety and function of the apparatus. We also had an opportunity to spend some time with a gentleman at the SEMO booth and to talk about the redesign that they have done on their stainless steel water tank, which is really kind of like, it's like a modified elliptical design that allows you, with the tank configuration, to be able to bolt and mount equipment to both the left side and the right side of the tank. Typically, one of the knocks on people would say on the pure elliptical tanks that we've known for water tankers or tenders over the years, it was pretty difficult to be able to mount stuff off the side. If you wanted to take ground ladders and a porta tank, sometimes that didn't always work very well, but with the redesign of this particular tank and the kind of unique baffle arrangement that it has, they actually had a cutaways to show you what it looked like. It was a kind of a neat improvement on something that's been around for quite a while. And that particular design, in talking to the gentleman, was going to be available from 1,500 gallons at the low end all the way up to 3,500 gallons. One of the other things that was of note in walking around was the number of units that have a traditional pump panel, as we've come to know them, or even if it was a PTO-driven pump, but it was that covered. It was in covered with a roll-up door on both the left side and the right side of the apparatus. The Seagrave booth, they had a very well-designed engine 312 for the Owings Mills Volunteer Fire Department in Baltimore County, Maryland, that had a big body pump, but was fully enclosed behind a roll-up door, left side and right side. Had a 500-gallon L-shaped water tank, so it had a real low hose bed off the back. All of the attack lines all came off the back. There were no cross laces. That particular unit runs in conjunction with a tractor-drawn ladder. And the gentleman that took us around said, you know, when you all your attack lines, and this came from him, didn't come from Brother Mike, he said, when you run with the ladder company, he says, and you have cross lays, because in that particular jurisdiction there are departments that run cross lay lines, he goes, the tendency is to try to position the rig so it's easy to stretch the line, which makes it pretty difficult for the ladder company to get a good position on the building. So this unit had all the attack lines coming off the back, and that in conjunction with the fact that it was a reasonably short unit, had 184.5-inch wheelbase and a overall length just over 31 feet, was a pretty well-designed unit. I think it had a total of either 5 or 6 pre-connected lines, big body pump, but again, all on a pretty short, compact unit. And right next to the Seagrave booth was the Marion Fire Apparatus Company that had 3 vehicles that all had different size pumps on their units, and they were all enclosed behind roll-up doors. So I think we're seeing the tendency to trying to have, to a point, more multi-purpose units, things where everything's behind a door of some sort to be able to reduce maintenance, to be able to keep the pump panel area clean, particularly if you're operating in an environment where you get some pretty severe winter weather. It just makes the unit a lot easier to clean up after taking up from a run and getting back to the station. And then finally, kind of worked our way up to the Emergency One booth, and they have a new heavy-duty, severe service interior treatment in their cab, where the dashboard is all metal and appropriately protected. The engine box was Linex'd, and again, that was probably one of the other things you've seen in a lot of the other redesigns of the cabs. A lot of cabs that we opened up, while it still is out there in the marketplace, much less use of ABS plastic and material. A lot of doors, I know that opened up a door of the couple of Sutphin cabs going around. The Seagrave cabs were that way. A couple of the KME cabs, full-height stainless steel protection panels on the inside, recognizing that we, as firefighters, with the number of tools we're coming in and out of the cabin with the masks and our SCBAs and other equipment, that the doors take a tremendous beating on the inside. So, again, a little bit more on the return of back to basics as I saw it. So, Mike, to wrap up, what was your impression of everything that we saw, all the different folks that we talked to, any particular theme or different variations on a theme that you saw at the show?
I just got the overwhelming sense that the manufacturers have really tuned into safety, from non-slip surfaces to wider cab door openings, to preventing slips and falls, to good visibility out of the cabs. I think the manufacturers have really gotten on the safety train. We looked around and didn't see the behemoth 10-man cabs. We saw a lot of cabs that were roomier, where firefighters would be able to put on seatbelts and buckle in and sit safely. and exit the cab safely. And our hats off to the industry for that.
Yeah, and just to summarize and pick up on that, amplifying that point, like things that you have talked about. So many more cabs that had all forward-facing seats and just three seats across, you know, facing forward, not going four shoulder to shoulder. In a couple of cases, the aerial devices, we'd always walk around the back of those. Several devices I can think of, again, there was a Sutphin 100-foot tower and a couple of other units that had higher ground ladder carrying capabilities that yes. than you would normally expect.
We saw that pumper that had a little bit of quad look from the day of yesteryear, right?
Yeah, there was a pumper on display that it appeared that the hose bed was high. When you opened up the door, it carried like about 125, 130 feet of ground ladders, almost a throwback to the days of the quad. A number of units that had steel bumpers or reinforced bumpers, like you said, you know, getting back to basics and safety. And I think whether departments are driving that or manufacturers are bringing that to the table, it's very heartening to see those products out there. The vast majority of the units that we looked at, you know, had customers names on them, so you can see people are paying attention to those important things. So that's the report and the wrap-up from the Fire Department Instructors Conference. This is Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, the apparatus architects. Until we get together again on the radio, stay safe and take care of yourself.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.